Design Tech, and I'm a student at Saginaw Valley College in Mr. Jezerski's Michigan History class. And it's June 23rd, 1972. I'm here tonight with Mr. Burke Lodewick, Sr. Burke, you've spent a lot of time in the Bay City area, but I think you might be interested to start with your experience as a child in lumber camp.
Everything ready for us, but when we got out there, and I still remember it was in the wintertime, straw on the sleigh and one thing or another, I was 3.5 years old, and my father had to put in some windows, build the fires and everything before we ever could get out of that sleigh and go on into the camp where it was warm, and then we just got the straw on the floor. Now that's what lumber camps were in those days, and I do remember that.
And what year was that?
That would be in 1905. Then, of course, we lived there for 2 years, and there were a lot of experiences. I was too young to go to school, but my brothers and sisters, the most of them were older than I was, and I remember they had 3 miles to go to school, and they passed by the Muskegon River, and this was very interesting because they would pass by and they'd set the fish boats. If people would come along, they knew those were our fish boats. They'd lift them up, they'd take the fish, put water in the tub, throw the fish in the tub, rebake the hooks and put them back in. So my brothers and sisters often came home with real nice fish from the Muskegon River. But of course, many days up in Dolphin, the Oder, and that's just beyond Harrison by Houghton Lake, where we lived. Our closest neighbor was 2 miles. So you can readily understand that there were an awful lot of days when it snowed and you just couldn't get out and go to school. So as far as schooling is concerned, they didn't get too much schooling in those days around us.
No buses?
That's right. There was no buses, absolutely. But anyhow, after 2 years of that, oh, there were several things that happened there, I think. For instance, one time I set fire to the barn. And my mother ran back and forth with a pail from the pump. And another woman was there, grabbed some marsh hay that had just been cut from the swamps and thrown in there and threw it on the fire and extinguished the whole thing. And the whole thing had been caught up in flames. Boy, I still would have probably been in jail. But nevertheless, that fire was put out. I got my witness chance for that. But then we went to Jennings. And this is quite interesting because in Jennings, that was strictly a lumbering town. That was probably 20 years. And when we went to Jennings, there were Copps and Mitchell's mill there, and they had a big sawmill, and it also had a big chemical plant. My father worked in the chemical plant. Well, we were there until I was in the second grade, then we moved to Cadillac. But in the meantime, Jennings had employed all these people. Right now, it was down to nothing. It's just one of these ghost towns, just like the old towns in the West are. It's strictly a ghost town. There's a lake there, and the town, one thing or another.
But this town's gone.
That's right. If you talk about the old, your heart belongs to the company store, that was the way this was. I still can remember going in there with my people and with my folks, my father paying the bill and come out with a nice big sack of candy for the family every time we'd pay the bill. And that was true in those days. They'd give you a nice big sack of candy. And they'd charge it, they'd take it out of your paycheck. That was the old paycheck. Yeah. Of course, that was just a branch of the Cosby's Mitchell plant in Cadillac, where we moved from there to Cadillac. Well, then I went from there to Cadillac, and then I was getting older, and of course it was easier to see all these lumbering days and things go in to see old then one team going along pulling. But there was a great trick to all these teamsters.
How much of the team was there?
Just two horses.
Two.
Just two. Yeah. But these, and I do remember from back in the lumbering days, when they just started, if you had a load of logs loaded, way up, like I said, 12, 14 foot bunks clear up, 15 feet high. When you got a hold of that team, it showed good teamsters. They'd sit there, they'd tighten the lines up, and then when they would tighten the lines up, these horses would start on the given signal, and they'd both go to the left and break those front runners. Go to the right, break the front runners. They'd slow them up and they started by jumping back and forth and keep going ahead. Once got it started, they were gone, and there was no stopping. It was very easy.
You couldn't just pull it straight ahead.
But if you started without breaking that thing and just pulled straight ahead, you never would get it started. You just pulled it straight ahead. They used to take their logs, and I thought this was interesting. They would take their logs and put them on the bank of the Muskegon River. And they would all year long keep putting them there, and there were great huge piles all along the bank. And then in the spring, when the frost was more or less out of the river and the fence was full and big, they would start dumping these logs in the Muskegon River. And these drives were sometimes maybe 2.5 miles long. And they'd just keep putting these logs in the river, dumping them in, and they'd flow right on down, and then they'd go from down to Leota, where a song is.
Now, is Leota still there?
No. There probably is a little place there that's called Leota, but that's another town that's probably evaporated. But they would take and saw these logs up, and every log would have its brand. And so the company would get it better. And it was quite a feat when they'd go down and these drives. Like this one lumber company would drive and they'd put 2.5 miles logs right in that river, right straight on down. And you could hear the people howling. Now, I remember this from my father. I don't remember this. But you could tell how that log drive was going by how the people, if they had ends, were hollering. And if they'd come to a jam where one log would get stuck and it starts to pile up, you could tell the tone of their voice and they're hollering and it'd go all up there. There's a jam up ahead or something. It was most interesting.
Well, did one outfit drive everybody's logs or their own logs?
They drove their own logs. They drive their own logs. They may hire somebody, but they drive their own logs. And you know,
what if another company had logs going down the river?
They took their time. In other words, we'll drive now, you drive then. Now, one other thing that was interesting in this thing too, I think, was this. Softwood floats faster than does hardwood. So you had to have softwood together, and you had to have hardwood together, or you could be in trouble. And the softwood would float faster because it runs higher in the water and goes on. The hardwood would sink a little lower for us, but just a little bit slower. Well, anyhow, that's as far as the...
What were the proportions of hardwood and softwood? There would have been a lot more
pine. I would
say
there was more pine than there would be hardwood. There was more. How much pine would there be? But now I remember when we get to Cadillac, and they had lumber mills all along Lake Mitchell. Huge, tremendous lumber camps. And how those sawmills were, I do remember that the Cadillac was a lumbering town. And of course, that's where I went nearly all through school and graduated from high school. But there were probably, like other lumbering towns, there were probably 7-8 millionaires in that town. People that had made money out of lumbering and had sawmills and flooring mills. They were nice with their money because they gave Cadillac a lot of privileges and things that other towns didn't have. Now, like they had an opera house there. It was a good one. And they had some of the finest entertainment in the world appear at this opera house, and people came. And I I remember I saw some of the performances myself, which I was very fortunate. One of them was like when Madam Sheila Hines came in. Now, she's noted all over the world for her voice, one of the leading singers in the world, even up to date. But when she came there, boy, that place wouldn't get back. Now, that was the type of entertainment they had. There were a lot. All of the streets were paved. Cadillac was a real going town. But after 1925, all the sawmills left and Cadillac had a nice town up there.
Why did the sawmills leave?
Well, they left because there wasn't any more lumber. I like Cobb, Mitchell, Cummer and Diggins. They were going clear up and were getting hardwood logs way up as far as Point City on the narrow gauge railroad. And they were taking all these logs in by narrow gauge railway, dumping them in the lake there, the log pond, and they would feed them up into the sawmill. That I remember they've done that. But they just cost was greater than what they could make. So in 1925, Cadillac was full as far as log concerned. And of course, they had with that their flooring plant, their chemical plants, everything else. But those were the log. Well, in about 1920, I graduated from high school there, and, you know, and I decided to go to Mount Pleasant College. And so I went there. And I became very much interested in teaching. And from that point on, I think I followed for a number of years. I followed the teaching schedule. At the time I went to Mount Pleasant, you could go out and teach. You could take the county examination, and they were the eighth grade, and they were tough. Boy, I still think a lot of high school graduates couldn't even pass them. The eighth graders had in those days, because they didn't fool any in those days. They just said, listen, Buster, you either pass this test or get out. See how they did. And when you could pass the eighth grade exam, it was quite a formal thing. Boy, they'd go in and the students in the grades would wait to see if they take an exam, see if they passed. And when they did pass, some of them wanted to go out. Well, at that time, high school was more or less the year because they people of professional things like teaching, industry, law, medicine, and various other things. So if they wanted to go on, they'd take college preparatory. In those days, they just said, listen, if you don't want to work, get the hell out of here. That's about all they said.
So these were public high schools.
Yeah, those were public high schools. And there were a lot fewer members than there are now. But at that time, as far as getting a teaching certificate, I think there was one time before a test, this would be about 1920. Well, I graduated in 1920. But like in 1915 or 14, along there, probably before World War II, I think you could take these eighth grade examinations and go for 6 weeks. And then you could go and teach them because that, if you passed eighth grade, you could succeed. Now, I believe that from that, these normal students get strength, that they would get courses, a 6 week course in the summer, and as you get a 6 week course, you can go and teach when you start to school. Now, in addition to that particular requirement, a little bit later, they said you can go so far as to get a limited certificate. That was for 1 year in college. And that, again, is where these normal schools played into play. And the normal schools, and like Cadillac, and all different towns that had a normal school, they'd enroll. And those weren't high school graduates that enrolled there. They just go there, spend the year, they go to the world. Well, then when I went there in about 1920, you'd get a limited certificate. That would let you teach for a little while. Or you could get what they called 2 years. A life certificate. Now that, you could teach for life. And I remember when I went there, that's what I did. I got a life certificate. After 2 years, I started teaching. And as a result of that, I was kind of young these people with life certificates still could carry on. The state said, you're going to have a life certificate. Well, then after they got the degree, then years later, they begin to say, now, wait a minute, you have to take refresher courses. And then they said, now, you can teach with a degree, as they do now, but you every so often have to take so many more courses and refresh yourself. And I suppose that it could carry on all the time. I don't know. It'd be too bad to ever get to that point. I think that some teachers are natural teachers. Well, then after I taught 1 year in high school, and I went back to college, once I graduated, and I taught there for a period of 14 years. And that was during the Depression. And of course, everybody had great expectations with salaries and everything, and that's just when consolidation started to begin. And I remember one thing that was very funny. One fellow was trying to say one school ought to be consolidated. But when he actually got down to get the number of students that were involved, so small they couldn't even have the one that he needed consolidating.
But what did you teach in Mountford?
I taught health and physical education. In fact, I started with a coach, and then coached baseball first, and then a basketball coach, and then I was athletic director. And then before I quit, I was acting as a teacher. That was during the Depression. Then during the Depression, salaries that you expected and you were supposed to get, but you didn't get, because you stayed in the state, and you were always forced to bear the paycheck stream every month. But it slowly went down, and finally they started cutting the salaries. Well, I suppose I took the first cut all right. And just about that time, I began to think to myself, now wait a minute, if I'm going to starve to death, I can starve to death as easily in the insurance business as I can in the teaching. So I weighed that all over for a couple of years. Finally, I decided anyhow that I was going to dedicate to myself, which I did. And I went to a strange town.
Bay City?
Yeah, Richard Bay City. I didn't know anybody back there. Only two kids that I'd had in school up at the time.
Well, what made you decide at Bay City? Because it was the largest town in the area?
No. I had kind of looked into Bay City, and there were two things that made me come to Bay City. One was this. I noticed that Bay City's population at that time was about 54,000.
This was what year?
This would be in 1937. And I thought, well, with all of these shipping facilities they have in the Bay City, and up the river, and large vessels going up the river, that Bay City should grow. And the reason that made me think that is when Henry Ford would go up to the Middle West and get iron ore and all that stuff and ship it down the lakes and through the canal and on down, clear down the Panama Canal and up over to Los Angeles, these cars over there, but there must be something in this lake and ocean shipping, okay? And I thought, sure, Bay City would go. So anyhow, I came here. I was ready to go with Bay City. Well, I didn't know why. I think if I have or not, but anyhow, we've got along pretty well. So everything was all right. I came up there, I was doing things like that. But the first few years in business, I'll tell you, we were pretty tough going. Real tough. You, a lot of you, there's a lot of young people now, if they have a little tough going yourself here. Boy, when you go back there, and you have three kids, and then the next year you have four kids, and you're in a brand new business and everything, you do a lot more than say, oh dear.
Now, did you consider that the Depression was over by 1937 in the Bay City area?
No.
It's still on.
It's still on. In other words, it was a depression. After the Depression. And of course, all of us were awfully sorry to see World War II, because it seemed that we were getting out of this Depression naturally. Then World War II came along, and supply and demand and everything went way up. And there was too much difference, except this, as manufacturing town, it does have an effect here. It does have a lot of effect as far as manufacturing town is concerned in Michigan, as far as Bay City is concerned. Now, I often wonder if we come up here to get concerns to come in, to do things, to operate, to make this a good city, have we or haven't? Some ways I think we have, some ways I think we have.
Well, what kind of things were going on?
Well, they were supposed to start to grow. They were supposed to start other things. Now, I'm speaking, this is my thought. If a town's ever going to grow, it ought to grow now. Well, it grew somewhat. The boundary lines, they said, it stayed about the same, which is nothing against it, I don't suppose. Maybe it's too bad, you know, it's too bad some of these other places didn't join the city to have a bigger area. For instance, like our school system. That we have a much bigger territory than just the plain ordinary Bay City. We have a much larger territory. Now, I personally agree, I think that's good. I think it's good. In fact, I thought it was good a long time ago. And in some ways, I think our place would have fired. Because having been a teacher for 14 years up at Central Michigan University, I couldn't come down there and keep my nose clean. I had to tell you, it dipped in, and I finally got in the Board of Education and so forth, and I was quite happy with it.
You know, how long was it between the time you got into Bay City and the time you got involved in school?
Oh, it probably was about 7 years, I would say. Tell you, I was so busy that first time, just making a living, I didn't have time to give that time to the Board of Education. But anyhow, when we went in there, and that's a interesting education in Bay City, and what's been done, I suppose. I think our forefathers' plan, as far as our educational system is concerned, is quite wise. They have all of the schools with a pretty good castle of ground around each school and pretty good schools. But at this particular time, we found out too that these schools started to be more or less fire towers. They weren't so good.
So now, what were the main schools in Bay City at that time?
Oh, it was about the same as it is now. Right here in Bay City, there were 17 different schools. Washington, Woodside, Romney, Regal, Farragut, that part, I'm sorry if I went down on some of them, but there were some.
Were there just still the same two high schools at that time?
There was only one high school.
Okay.
Just one high school. And that was basically Central. Now, shortly after I got on the Board of Education, the people had voted to do this, whether they want to basically hand a junior high school, become a senior high school or not. And just before they voted to do that, they voted in their own department. How many votes separated? If they did want a high school on the west side of the school. So anyhow, the people voted it, that's what it was. Well, then I got on the Board of Education. We went along. became a pay-as-you-roll 60 instead of a 50.
How much opposition was there?
Well, there wasn't very much because it was 2-1 in favor. 2-1 in favor of this program. I still remember, though, and this might be of interest, the first, when we got this all set up, we called meetings of businessmen and others. And we talked about this is what we could do for this amount of money. And it wouldn't be too much, and they should be for it. But at first, people were very much against it. But when they listened to us, they became for it. And then, the first meeting we had, I remember very, very well, we called the PTA. We just took two people from every PTA because we wanted a fixed group. And I was president of the Board of Education then, so I made them the talk. And I talked, and I still remember there was one woman in there getting called the same and following along. This woman kept saying to me, Mr. Logan, how much money? And I said, well, yes. Now look, 4.5 mills is what, 1 mill is $1,000. That means $4.5 on a thousand. And so I go on, and well, the third time in the hour, I knew it couldn't be better anymore, so finally I swallowed 3 times, and she said, how much money is that? And I swallowed about 3 times, and I said, that's $5.5 million. And I said, right there, this woman looked at me and she said, why, Mr. Loder, do you mean we'd get all that for only $5.5 million?
Okay.